Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 38 of season 11 of Movie Around Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 award-winning HBO miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again to finish off her three-episode stint is documentarian extraordinaire Kristen Taylor. Welcome back to the show for yet another grueling task of having to talk to me for like almost an hour, Kristen.
That's not a grueling task. I'm happy to be back. Thanks for having me. The only thing that's hard is these episodes I chose.
but that goes without saying. That's someone's got to talk about them, and why not
somebody who's
a little bit more familiar with Carrington than others. So I don't have a problem with that. That works for me.
Anyway, good to see you. Thanks for having me.
Yes. All right. And you're very welcome for me having you back. So episode 38 begins with Lythe trying to get out of his foxhole and ends with Winters giving a little bit more information as to what's in store for everybody. Mm-hmm. So we left things yesterday with this little, the end part of the battle.
A tiny little, yeah.
We reached the point, we knew that Blythe was trying to keep himself safe in the foxhole, and Soldier comes by and is amazed that he was able to make it out. Like this scene reminds me again. I know I've mentioned this many times, but Platoon, you have, the point where at the end where you have all these fresh soldiers just showing up right after the battle has completely decimated everything around them, and mm-hmm. they just like looks, these are guys. It looks like they're in fresh uniforms and everything's clean and stuff like that. And here you got a guy who's just showing up right at the end. So it fits in with that.
It does. It also reminds me of a scene from Peter Jackson's, recreation of the World War I footage that he did.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've seen that. Okay. Yeah.
What's the name of that film?
I don't remember.
They Shall Not Grow Old. They Shall Not Grow Old.
Right. Okay.
And it's basically the same thing with guys coming off the line and other ones going back in, they're just walking off by the camera and they're just, just look awful. And, they have the same thing in Band of Brothers later on, where I think it may be from Foy, where they're walking out of Foy maybe, or I don't know. There's a change where they're being pulled off the line and the new replacements are going in. I can't remember where that's happening, but. Mm-hmm. Kind of the same thing.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of when it was either, but I can't remember either. So
yeah.
Right. So Blythe is just crawling out of the foxhole, and he gets up and looks around at everything that's going on here.
He's literally shell shocked.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And now he wants to go back to where he was shooting at that soldier beforehand, just to see what happened, because he shot the soldier and then the soldier disappeared. And he's not sure what happened to him.
Yeah, and this scene, I just rewatched it actually right before this. And the scene really is so powerful. And it's interesting watching it in these 5 minute segments like you've divvied up, because I'm specifically focusing on this moment. Whereas when you're watching it in a whole episode, you might not be as focused on a certain moment. And
that's part of the whole idea of Movies by Minute, that you're gonna look at things in a different way because you're just looking at small portions. You're not looking at everything all
right.
together.
Yeah. And so in this little section, again, we're watching this transformation of this soldier who just in this very short time, you've seen him going from, screaming in his foxhole with wanting everything to just go away like a baby who can't take this overstimulation and this fear, to coming out of that at the, encouragement and almost like, the dad encouraging his son to stand up and become a man, standing there beside Dick Winters, and him growing at that moment and doing what he has to do. And so you think, okay, he's there, he's done it, he's overcome in this moment, this challenge. So, okay, so the moment is over and like I said earlier, you then see the after effects of that, just the shell-shocked nature of his face. I mean, the actor just is just so masterfully portrays Blythe in his just overwhelmed, you know, in the moment. And it's, and even after he crawls out and he's slowly walking through the woods trying to find out what happened to him. And just the filmmaking of this moment where they are watching everything he does, where they're, the way that they're cutting on each different thing, whether it's, you know, his point of view as he's walking through the woods, or the scene looking down where you see the bloody gauze, or, you know, and you're kind of led along the pathway as if you are Blythe in one parts of it. Then in other parts, they're cutting to his hands and the flower, as you see, he's looking at, you know, his face, and then you see his hands touching the Edelweiss in his jacket. And then we are now outside. Now we're not now looking as Blythe. We're looking at Blythe as the audience, and we're seeing his face. And I'm sitting there just wondering what is going through his mind exactly. You know, he's shell-shocked, you know, but what is he really thinking? And I find myself when I'm interviewing veterans often, I just want to know exactly what they were thinking and feeling at a specific time, because, you know, they didn't know what it would be before they got in the minute.
Right.
And honestly, when they're in the minute, it's overwhelming. They don't really know. And he probably didn't even really realize it when he was in the minute, you know?
Right. But the question is, you know, can they remember something that happened 80 years ago, what they were thinking or feeling at a particular time?
And sometimes they do. Like I think I mentioned before, Al Mampre, where he so vividly recalled the moment when he was shot in Holland, trying to help Brewster. And he remembered the sound around him and the lady screaming. And he remembered what he was thinking, and it never goes away. So sometimes it's one or the other. In this instance, you know, I'm sitting here watching this actor process what this character has just gone through. And what I see on his face in some moments is wonder, and I see confusion. And then I see, is that compassion on his face? Is that sadness on his face? Is he putting himself in the position of the soldier? You know, and as a filmmaker, I can never sometimes, you know, I'm going back and forth all the time by being moved, like I'm a regular person watching the film. And then other times I'm acutely aware of what the filmmakers are doing to make me feel that way. So this time I caught the music. The music was so brilliant. If you listen to when they're touching, you know, he's touching the little Edelweiss flower, it changes, you know, to kind of reflect that Austrian Edelweiss music. And it gets very soft and begins to resolve. And so you do begin, you'll see, that the music helps you understand a little bit about what the filmmakers want you to think Blythe might be feeling. And so we're led to believe that Blythe is processing this in a tender way, in a way where he feels compassion. He doesn't feel anger towards this man. And where, you know, Garnier has all of this anger there built up towards, you know, the Germans, and many others did as well, and would have kicked him or taken whatever was on his person. Blythe didn't do that. And you see him take that Edelweiss flower, but not as a spoils of war, you know. And I do wonder, like, what was that? What did that mean? Was it a, I've killed this man and this is my prize? I don't feel that way. I feel it was like, it was more of a, I'm going to carry carry on for you in a weird way. I don't know the answer to that, but I do feel in that moment there was compassion and that he wasn't taking that Edelweiss flower in a prideful way.
Right.
Proud okay. of what he did.
That's fair. I mean, first of all, the whole idea of the Edelweiss is something that the writer of the episode made up. It's not in the book. You know, so it's not something that I guess really happened with Blythe that you can try to put it in. I mean, we talked last week about the whole idea of the Edelweiss. You know how it and you know because Nixon mentions the fact that the Edelweiss is the reason they walk around within their lapel is because it's something that's so high in the mountains that it's very difficult to get to, and that's that shows some way of that that shows the eliteness of this type of soldier, that type of thing. Right. But we're jumping a little bit ahead of ourselves, so let's move back a little bit.
All right.
Basically,
we're still in the foxhole.
We're out of the foxhole. He's walking up, okay. And he reaches the point where the soldier that he shot had fallen before he disappeared, and that's when he sees on the ground the gauze, the bloody gauze. So he knows that he did hit somebody. And then, like a good detective, he starts walking off, in the direction that he believes this guy possibly disappeared into, in order to try and figure out what's going on. Now, it's also very interesting because the battle is over. He's very sure and confident of himself, and he's not as fearful as he was beforehand.
I don't know that I would agree with you that he's assured and confident.
He's trying to solve a mystery right now, and he knows that he's not in the middle of a battle. So that's
he knows he's. I would agree. He knows he's not in the middle of a battle, but I think he's walking tentatively, slowly, and I think he's processing emotions. And yes, trying to solve what happened, wondering if he died, wondering if he, where he went. But I do still think he's processing what's happening.
Okay, I can agree with that, but I think he has put himself on a journey here, because this is basically the first person that he has shot.
Right.
So he's now on a journey to find to find out who he is, to find out, is he someone who is able to kill somebody, and how will he react when he sees the person he shot? Whether True. It's again, whether he killed him or he didn't kill him, that's why he's on guard. He knows that it's possible that someone's going to jump out at him along the way.
Yeah, you kind of see that when I think at the beginning where he goes to touch him and he kind of wonders, is he still alive? You feel that little tension, maybe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so he's walking through the woods. He's following. He sees more bandages on the ground, bloody bandages. And then he does see the soldier lying on the ground. And, he slowly walks towards this soldier, as you said, to see what's going on. Is this guy alive? Is he not? He sees that it was basically a gut shot. And he sees the deadness in the eyes, and then he like looks around, and the question is what is he looking around for? Is he looking around to make sure that nobody is watching what's about to happen or not? And then he leans down, and then he takes the Edelweiss from the lapel, and I think, you mentioned before that it's not a spoils of war, and I agree, but I think in some ways it's a souvenir. And maybe it's also, you can even look at it from an existential perspective, that here you have a flower that's been cut, but it's not withered. So therefore, it's not alive, but it's also not dead. So I would say that that's also somewhat of a connection of what he's looking at here. If these elite troops have to go all the way up high into the Austrian Alps in order to get an Edelweiss, and they're going to walk around with it, they're not walking around with a dead leaf on their, a dead flower on their lapel.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know enough about flowers. Maybe in some ways, what is it that you can like dry out a flower or something like that?
Yeah, it's clearly not a dried out flower. And I highly doubt that unless he had a whole jar of them that he put one in his lapel every day, that that flower would have made it from, you know, the time he got it at the top of the Alps to Carentan, just like it was. You know, and like you said, it wasn't in the book, and it is a filmmaker's, you know, tool. And of course, that's what filmmakers do. They have liberty to tell their story in the way they want to do it. So
Exactly. And it makes sense. It makes sense for them to do it this way.
Yeah. I think they're wanting to tell, they're wanting to demonstrate. They're using Blythe to demonstrate a journey of a soldier like Blythe. So he is a stand-in for many who were like Blythe. Yeah. And we're seeing what that journey was like for many soldiers.
Exactly. And as you said, the music is unbelievable. Forget about, the music is unbelievable, period, for the entire series.
Yeah.
But the way that they use the music here is also just amazing.
Yeah, you know, I agree.
And it makes the scene even more emotional, you know, as he's putting the flower into his own lapel with the whole thing.
Yeah. And it really, really is setting us up.
Yes.
You know? I from the beginning of this scene, the only, I don't know if you call it a criticism, but you know, you just feel so set up from the beginning that you see how much Blythe doesn't want to be in war because he's afraid that something's going to happen to him. You know, the foreshadowing is there from the moment it starts.
Completely. Completely. And then the screen fades to black. And then we get a title card that says D-Day plus 25, which means we are now on July 1st.
Oh, that's what I was wondering. So we're on July 1st.
Mm-hmm.
So where are they? They are.
Right. They don't tell us at this point where they are. My assumption is they are still around Carentan. No, they've moved on.
No.
Okay. But they don't ever mention where they are.
I know. I'm trying to figure it out.
Well, first of all, the chapter in the book called Move Out, which is Carentan, goes from June 7th to July 12th.
Oh, you know, that's true. You are right. I'm wrong. Because I remember the P-47s landed there in early July. Because do you remember the P-47s when they came in?
Mm-hmm.
So they landed in Carentan. I only recently learned this, actually, because well, I guess it really doesn't matter, but there is a whole journey that I have been on in France where I was invited to go to the Alsace-Lorraine region because there was people that saw my film, a man that saw my film, whose father crashed there outside Zwolkirchen and Pulfstroff, right in the middle between those two towns outside in this little Alsace-Lorraine region. And his dad was a P-47 pilot, and he was one of the very first ones to fly them and land in Carentan, and it was right during that area. And I have seen all of the letters and have copies of the letters that he wrote from Carentan. So, yes, I'm wrong.
Okay. That's perfectly
so right. I've forgotten that. All right. So we're still in Carentan.
We are still in Carentan. I mean, we'll talk about it a little bit. The book is slightly different. The truth is slightly different than what we're watching here. But, you know.
Well, what is it? Tell us the difference.
I'll tell you after. First, we'll go with what's going on here. So, again, they're around Carentan here. And, you know, we see Nixon is with Welsh. And Nixon goes, "We need to know what's in there." They're looking at a building that's, and Welsh goes, "I don't know who the hell to send. Ask for volunteers, because I hate asking for volunteers. Then pick them. Need to take a look at that farmhouse. Who wants to go?" And, you know, surprisingly, Blythe volunteers. So it already shows that within these 2 weeks or 2.5 weeks since we last saw Blythe, something has changed in him that he's volunteering to take a point. And they go, anyone else? And they go, Martin, Dukeman, you just volunteered. Hubba hubba.
Yep.
And then Blythe says, I'll be lead, which again sounds very, very suspicious because it's not something that he normally would have done 2.5 weeks before, but I guess something's, something has changed. And he goes, Blythe's lead scout, move out. And then Nixon turns and goes, Harry, what exactly are you doing with your reserve chute? You've been hauling that thing around ever since we jumped. And he says, well, I'm going to send it to Kitty when we get back to England. Silk. Figure it'll make a good wedding dress, you know? What with rationing and all. So I like how they just thread this in, pun intended. You know, how they just mention it in passing as, you know, the patrol has moved on. And, you know, Welsh and Nixon are just in there. And, you know, he's like, why are you still carrying around your reserve chute? And it sort of makes sense. I mean, I don't know how many women in the 1940s would have agreed to make a wedding dress out of a parachute, but, you know, I guess there's at least, or at least Welsh believes that that's what Kitty wants to do.
Well, I mean, there were a lot. There were a lot. I mean, I'm so curious as to how many there actually were, but you know, it was very common in France and very common in the U.S. because I've seen a lot of them and heard a lot of stories.
Okay.
Because of exactly what he says.
I guess the rationing that people did want to do. So that makes sense.
Yeah. The fabric rationing.
Right. I mean, it is mentioned in the book. It does say in Welch's backpack, he carried his reserve parachute. He carried it throughout the Normandy campaign. I wanted to send it back to Kitty to make a wedding gown for our marriage after the war. And then in the book, it says optimism with a question mark. So, yeah, that's an interesting way for them to just throw that in there right in the middle. But I like it. I think it works the way that they do that.
Yeah, I liked it too.
Yeah. And at this point, Nixon says to him, geez, Harry, never would have guessed. What, that I'm so sentimental? He goes, no, that you think we're going to make it back to England.
Yeah.
Which is also a great line with the way that they, you know, there definitely is optimism here from Welsh with this idea that he wants to move forward and use this as a wedding dress eventually. And, you know, that in itself asks the whole question, you know, like, what do these men really think? I mean, we had the conversation with you know, between Blythe and Spears, where Spears basically said, just you have to do everything here as if you know you're about to die. And that's it. You know, don't think about living. Just think about, you know, what you have to do as if you're already dead. And here we have the exact opposite. We have someone who is hopeful and he's carrying around extra weight. You know, they're already carrying enough weight with them. But he's carrying around extra weight in order to be able to, you know, use this for practical purposes, perhaps years from now, you know, a long time from now. Who knows how long he's going to have to hold it.
Right.
Then the shot changes and we're back with the patrol. And we see that Blythe is leading them.
Yes.
That's great. Blythe is walking, you know, in front of all of them. And he starts, he says, okay. And then he turns around in order to motion to the guys, you know, that they're, as they're getting closer to this house. And then we hear a gunshot ring out, and Blythe gets hit in the neck. And we see that he falls to the ground. Welsh says, here we go again. Covering fire. You know, knowing that, all right, you know, we don't know how many days it's been quiet for them, but it's no longer quiet. And Martin runs over to Blythe and goes, hang in there, Blythe. Come on, keep moving down. And he goes, medic up. And they see where the shots are coming from. And one of them goes, top window right. And Martin says then to Blythe, hang in there, medic. We need a medic down here. And they shoot into the building. And at this point, Welsh realizes that, you know, there's no reason for him to continue shooting. And he goes, cease fire. And then Martin grabs Blythe and goes, take it easy, Blythe, take it easy. Come on, Duke. Come on. And then Doc Rowe shows up. And I love how they just, you know, throw Doc Rowe into all of these situations, even though he was, it's not written that he was there, but they, you right. know, from Bruce McKenna told me this, and everyone will eventually hear the interview with him, and he'll talk about that, how, you know, you have a character that is going to be a central point later, and you want to have him at least show up beforehand, so people don't have to wonder who this new character is. You know, he's been around and that type of thing. So Doc Rowe shows up and he goes, move, coming through, give me room, out of my way. And he looks at the wound and goes, I got it. And he starts dealing with taking care of the wound. And then Winter shows up and Winter goes, what happened? Walsh goes, sniper. And Doc goes, all right, Blythe, I got you. Nice and easy. And then Winter turns to Walsh and goes, they're pulling us off the front line. He goes, now? He goes, to a field. And he gets cut off as yeah. he's explaining where they're going to be taken. So as I teased before, I will actually now read the few paragraphs that deal with this particular event.
Great.
In their foxholes, the men of Easy stayed underground, ready to repel any ground attack, but otherwise remaining out of sight during daylight hours. Lieutenant Nixon, Battalion Intelligence Officer S2, wanted to know the strength of the German infantry opposite Easy's position. Winters came down the line, asking for a volunteer to take out a high noon patrol. No one responded. He told Garnier that he was nominated to lead the patrol. Garnier got a briefing from Nixon, who gave him a map showing all the hedgerows and a cluster of farm buildings that seemed to be a German command post, almost a kilometer away. Garnier, Privates Blythe and Joseph Lisnowski of Erie, Pennsylvania, and two others set out. Using the hedgerows for concealment, they moved forward. Blythe was at point. He reached the last hedgerow leading to the farm buildings. A German sniper put a bullet in his neck. Get the hell out of here, Garnier shouted as the patrol fell back. German machine pistols opened up. When the patrol got back to Easy lines, the company's machine guns answered the fire. Again, that's all they say here about it. You know, that and Blythe is mentioned like two or three times in the entire story here, you know, in the entire book.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They're using him as the character to demonstrate, you know, to be the stand-in for how, you know, many other men that actually went through that, you know, experience. Mm-hmm. So what does the book say immediately next?
It just moves on to another patrol that Malarkey did. Mm. You see, they don't pay any attention to this, really, from the whole thing.
Hmm. Wow.
I mean, that's do mention the fact that Blythe had hysterical blindness and stuff like that, but also the whole idea that Blythe died right after, you know, like 2 years after the war from his injuries isn't true. So, you know, someone, it got through the fact checkers, you know, that type of thing.
Hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, I think what they were trying to do here with Blythe is, as you said, show, you know, how a scared soldier can possibly change over the course of thing. But I don't think they give it enough time, because it's something that happens so briefly and so quickly.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, look, from a filmmaker's perspective, you don't get that luxury, right? You just don't have time. So that's why. We never have time to tell everything we want to tell. We have to sacrifice our babies. So you have to figure out a way to shrink everything, because in life, it always takes much longer.
Yes. Oh, of course. I'm not trying to knock that. I'm just saying, you know, from the perspective of there's so much that they're trying to tell here. So,
yes.
You know, the story of Blythe is not the only thing that they're telling here. I mean, I've mentioned this many times, and I'm sure I will mention this many times over the next 100 episodes that we still have, or 98 episodes, but the amount of information and stories they could tell from the Men of Easy could fill up numerous other miniseries, movies. 10 hours is not even close to being enough.
No, nope. But, so true.
You know, they still did an amazing job with the 10 hours they had.
Yep. Agreed.
Yeah. All right. Is there anything else that you want to say about this 5-minute segment or about Band of Brothers in general?
To me, it is amazing how it does still hold up 25 years later.
Mm-hmm.
How it just it hasn't, I mean, it's still relevant. It's still interesting. It's not, I don't think that it would look tremendously different today. If it did, I wouldn't like it. I just think it's just, I'm thankful for the series. It's taught me a lot. I think this particular, you know, how many minutes, 15 minutes that we've talked through?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is just so intense of how much, you know, has happened in this 15 minutes, personally and in the battle. It's a lot to cover. And even in this 5 minute, how much has happened, you
yes.
know, how many things you've talked about, you know, it's just a lot. And it's just, you know, like you said, so funny that they've thrown in the middle of this whole situation, talking about the wedding dress, you know, the parachute, but that happens too. And
but I actually like the way they do that because it gives, it develops the characters even more.
Yeah.
You know, we learn about Welsh, the fact that he's saying something like that, you know, and at the same time, we know that, okay, he has a girlfriend/fiance named Kitty, you know, that he, you know, he has someone that he's looking forward to getting back to. Yeah, that type of thing.
Yeah, and the thing is, those things happen, like, in the middle of that intense thing, and they do because it's like us being at work, really. We're at work, we're doing our job, we're talking to our buddy. Our mind is not on work. You know, we're with our people, we're just talking about whatever. We are still aware, you know, or it's like baseball players in the middle of a baseball game, first baseman, you know, guy's just, you know, taking his hit, he's got on first and he's chatting it up with the first baseman. Now he knows he's got to be ready to run any minute. So he's keenly aware of what's going on, but he doesn't have to be as keenly aware because it's not his first time at the plate. It's not his first time at first base, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And also it's their way of dealing with the tension, you know?
Right.
It's their way of, just like with military humor, it's very dark and, you know, civilians, I don't think, understand it oftentimes, but it's their way of dealing with the tension. I do want to encourage people to read more about the Battle of Carentan and, you know, more deeply, because, you know, the 101st Airborne Division did amazing things there, and it's not just easy company. You know, it was taken by three different, you know, there were three different colonels that were in charge of, you know, these companies and regiments, and it took a whole group of men, hundreds and hundreds of men, coming from three different directions to take this town. And they ended up, you know, toasting one another at the, you know, they call it the Marie, I think, you know, the town hall. Once it was, you know, they thought they had the town on the 12th. And there's just some wonderful scenes, or some wonderful stories like that. And if you ever get a chance to go and visit the town of Carentan, a lot of people skip by. And I real highly, you know, suggest you don't. It's just a really wonderful place to visit. And the Normandy Victory Museum is a fantastic museum to visit. And there's just the Place de République is a great place to spend the day, eating pizza under the colonnades and visiting the medieval church there. It's just a wonderful place to spend a day. So,
all right, very cool. All right, so today's segment is Oh Brother, where my guests will give their top five movie pairs of brothers.
So, all right, I can't wait. I've given this some thought.
I am so happy. Start with your number five and work your way up.
Okay, and I'm going to take a little bit of liberties here.
What a surprise.
I have more than five.
What do you mean you have more than five? It's top five.
I know, but I have more than five. And
Okay, well, anything not in the top five won't get points. All right. You can make
points.
No, that's correct.
Okay. All right. So I guess I'm going to have to narrow them down then. All right. So hang on a minute. What do I want to do with number five? All right. Number five, Little Giants.
Okay.
Number five, Little Giants. Number four is going to be The Blind Side. Now, I don't know if you want to call that fictional brothers or not, because it's kind of based on a true story, but
I didn't say anything about fictional. It doesn't need to be fictional.
Okay. Okay, good. All right. Three. And this is a documentary, so I don't know if it counts, but Three Identical Strangers.
Oh, I love that movie. I mean, it's scary as hell, but yeah.
It is scary as hell, but I think it's a great movie.
Yeah, no, now, I love it. I've seen it two or three times. Wow.
Number two is Rudy.
Okay.
That is again.
You're a going narrative. Yeah, you have three out of four so far football.
Yeah, I know. And the one you won't let me count is, well, anyway, let me give you number one. Number one is, it's more of the Band of Brothers concept, but it's Best Years of Our Lives.
Okay.
Because they're brothers in war, not actual brothers. But the other ones that you won't let me count are Remember the Titans. Okay. Because
another football movie. You should be a football person.
Well, I live in a house of five men, so and they have played football and lacrosse. So, yes, I've watched a lot of football movies.
So there are no lacrosse games, no lacrosse choices on this one.
Yeah, there's not a lot of really good lacrosse movies, actually. And then the other one I had on here is actually a movie with brothers in it, but they don't play brothers in the movie, but Duck Soup. With the Marx Brothers.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Okay, there you go. Excellent.
All right. And now we will play the daily game of name that World War II movie.
Okay. So never your best guess on your guest on this one, but.
Yeah, well, we'll spin the wheel and see what you get this time.
Okay.
Oh wow! Okay, I'm curious if you're gonna know this one. Okay, this is a movie from 1958, and it is a musical about World War II.
Okay.
Do you need any more hints, or is that enough for you to already guess or give up?
No, I need you to help me.
It's with Mitzi Gaynor and John Kerr. And Ray Walston and Rossano Brazzi.
Nope, need more details.
Okay.
In the '50s, and it's a musical. It's a musical. I don't even know any.
It's a musical.
I don't even know any.
It's a musical about sailors.
Oh. See, I don't even know any of those actors. But is it South Pacific?
Yes, it is. Very good.
Uh-huh.
You see, nicely done. Nicely done. You're supposed to know these things. You know, you're a World War II fanatic, and
I am no supposed
offense,
to know these things.
No offense.
And you gave us
you're a woman who probably
a list of musicals. World War II movies to review. I do love musicals. I looked at that list and I was like, oh my word, I have a lot of movies I need to watch.
Yes, you do. there's plenty of time. Funny. That's the great thing about movies. You can watch them whenever. You know, you don't need to.
That's true.
You know, it sounds if you miss it. It's not like back in the, you know, in the early days when you missed it, that's it. You have to wait until it's being shown again.
Yeah, true.
So, Christian, can you would you like to tell everyone once again where they can find you?
So, everybody can find me at documentaryfirst.com. Same on all the socials, as well as our Documentary First podcast.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is easy. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@movierob.net. So Christian, thank you very much for once again coming back to join me to talk about a World War II movie. You know, maybe next time you'll come back and talk about something that's not a World War II movie, if I do one.
Yes, there are plenty of other movies I can talk about.
Yes, sure. There are. All right. So I'll be back tomorrow with another guest. But until then, Curhee!
Curhee!